as a theorician, a guy who wrote theory from Haiti called, he was an anthropologist called Jean Price-Mars. And he's somebody that Leopold Sédar Senghor really admired.
Okay.
And because of that, he had called on a lot of teachers from Haiti at the time of the dictatorship of Duvalier that went to Dakar, and who really had a good presence there. So they really like Haitian in Senegal. So that's yesterday that even happened with a lot of African artists from all over the continent.
Interesting.
And we sincerely hope that the new, your listening audience will join Josaphat and Yolaine on Tuesday.
Yeah.
To share more of the situation in Haiti at St. Francis College.
This I want to get to. Plus, I'm going to be dealing with Haiti in a sense later on. That is in weeks. Not right now, because everybody is speaking about Haiti, of course, when it happens and so on and so forth. But we have a super producer in Ian Forrest, and we're going to make sure that we get back to a discussion of Haiti later on. Now, Ewen, the event on Tuesday, telephone number where people can get information and so on. You can just kind of wrap this up for us because we've got to go.
The Caribbean Cultural Theater, our telephone number is 718-783-8345. That's 718-783-8345. The event, Poets and Passion, St. Francis College, 138 South Oxford, 182 Remsen Street, downtown Brooklyn. Looking forward to your audience. Looking forward to everybody in the community. Tout bagay.
Tout moun bagay.
To come true.
Again, our telephone number is 718-783-8345.
718-783-8345. Monsieur Large, merci beaucoup.
Merci beaucoup. Merci en pile ou même.
And
thanks a lot to you.
Yeah. Mr. Ewen McDonald, me thank you.
What good, my son. What good.
Yeah. I saw it go. We much appreciated. And to all of you who tuned in, thank you very much. We'll be back next week with another edition of the program. Please do stay tuned for Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund, which comes up at 5 o'clock. Meantime, you have been listening to Labrish. My name is Hapte Selassie. We'll be back next week with another edition of the program. Labrish is produced by Ian Forrest with assistance from Seduzo Kaim Billy and is a The Jazz Mac production. Remember to tell the people whom you love that you love them and show affection. With love, we'll find unity and strength. One love, walk good. Mr. Tosh.
On one foundation. Got to build our love. On one foundation. Got to build our love. On one foundation.
There will never be, no love at all. There will never be no love at all. I've got to put aside name segregation. I've got to put aside name organization. I've got to put aside. There will never be no love at all. I mean, there will never be no love at all. So build our love on one foundation. Come, let us build our love on one solid foundation. Got to build our love.
together. We are birds of a feather. We got to come together, 'cause we are birds of a feather. We got to come together, 'cause we are birds of a feather. Or there will never be, Lord of mercy, no love at all. There will never be, yeah, yeah, no love at all. We also got to realize we are one people, yeah. Got to realize that we are one people, yeah. We got to realize we are one people, or there will never be no love at all.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, not preempted. My name is Jim Freund, a weekly program of science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. This morning, sadly, the first of what will be a couple of memorial or tribute shows this month, one later in the month. This morning, Cage Maker, with me. Thank you. listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM. Fading in the background, Steel Ice Band, of course, with the song London. And we opened, as always, with The Space Fleet from the soundtrack of the motion picture Silent Running, music by Peter Schickele. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund, and February is over, meaning that the thon, the fundraising drive of February, is done with, discarded away. I think we actually get like 3 months of programming before we start pulling teeth again. And amazingly, I was only preempted once out of four shows. Simon twice. I mean, that's strange. But Simon raises a lot of money and all that. Well, I mean, we did okay here. We did okay. You know, we did raise money. And by the way, let me thank you all for pledging as you did. But also, since pretty much the beginning of the year, I'm afraid I must complain. It has been a miserable year in terms of losing people, Cage Baker is one of those folks. She was 58, and that's, you know, another friend of mine, John Glidman, Margot Adler's husband, died about 3 weeks ago at age 60 or 61. William Ten, the other person who we're going to memorialize later this month, probably last week of the month, at least had the grace to be an elderly man. I think he was 89 or 91. He was in that range. So at least there people can't say, well, I mean, they were all taken too early. Even Phil Klass at age 90 was taken too early because, as far as I'm concerned, mortality is, like, wrong. And that's something, actually, that we're going to be discussing this morning, come to think of it. Yeah, mortality or immortality. I'll bet one of the reasons I can't hear you is that I had the wrong mic turned on. Oh, that's much better.
Good.
Yeah. With me this morning is Amy Goldschlager, who, this is what, your second or third?
Second time.
Second time on the program. Amy is, although many, second time on the program live, you've been heard often as a curator of the New York Review of Science Fiction series for your tenure there.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, I point that out, that people have been on the show when least they expected it occasionally. This happened to one writer recently, and she had the poor grace to curse while reading a story, and since it was on tape, I can't blame her.
Ah, yes.
Yes. Sorry.
But, I mean, I'm here because I was a huge fan of Cage Baker. I still am a huge fan. Excuse me. And fortunately, I was actually in a position to do something about it.
Well, before we get there, let me just do finish announcements, and then we'll go right to that. Let's see. Announcements are next week on this program. My guest will be N.K. Jemisin, whose novel The 100,000 Kingdoms is just coming out this week, and who about 2 or 3 weeks ago was nominated for a Nebula Award for novella, which is just way cool. Three out of the six nominees, may I point out, for a short story were on this program. No, it's a short story she's nominated for. So I'll be having the fourth on, and she was scheduled months ago, a while ago. Oh, yes, the fourth person who died was somebody very near and dear to us at WBAI, and attentive listeners have heard David Nolan, who was an engineer here for many years. David had turned 48 on Valentine's Day, and he had a heart attack on the subway last Tuesday. And died. I mean, so unexpected and current that I received an email from him after he had died. Facebook, not quite the same thing as email, but close enough. I had not been that much in touch with David recently, but we had worked together a great deal in the past, and he was actually going to help me with archiving all the tapes and stuff I've got, and various other things. He was working at NYC. He was the archivist of all the readings at the 92nd Street Y. Recordist and archivist, and he'd become the official archivist at NYC and QXR. In two words, this sucks. His memorial was last week at St. Mark's, appropriately, where he would record the poetry get-togethers, a function started here by also the late John Fisk. I mean, you know, I'm not a kid, but we're too young to be dealing with losses this heavy. So I had to mention that. So that's next week is Nora Jemison will be here. And then the week after that, Chicks Who Dig Time Lords. I mean, that, you know, that says it, right? Tempest Bradford, Cat Valenti and crew. Are going to have, I mean, I shudder at the incorrect term. They will bear it, you know, they say, yeah, I'm a chick, so I can call myself that. And I go, I don't know about that, but hey, whatever. The name of the book is Chicks Who Dig Time Lords. And they will be celebrating their chickiness, their Time Lord happiness, or whatever. 2 weeks from now. And, you know, that's just too fun and too geeky a show not to have done. Tempest had mentioned this book coming out when last she was here with the whole Altered Fluid gang. And at that moment, I knew that we had to have an event and a show. So more about that next week. So at any rate, Amy is here this morning.
Hello.
And let's go back. I finished my announcements. The first reading of the New York Review of Science Fiction was last Tuesday and was fun. Wait, is KGB this week or next week? It's this week.
What, KGB?
Yes.
KGB is the third week
usually
of
the
February.
Third Wednesday.
Yes.
Not the third week, but the third Wednesday.
Yes.
And it's
we'll only be in week two. Because NERSIF is the first Tuesday.
Yeah, so and we did, went week. On the second. Okay. And that will be Nora Jemison and Michael Shea, as a matter of fact. Yeah, that's right. And I'll be interviewing Michael Shea on the day of the reading.
Okay.
Okay, so I'm sorry.
So Cage Baker, yes. I guess it must have been in the mid to late 90s. Gardner published...
Gardner Dozois?
Gardner Dozois published...
There's a cab driver out there who may not have heard of...
Yes. Published a story of Cage Baker's called Noble Mold, about a mysterious company and time-traveling immortals who must rescue a grapevine. And then a little bit later, I must have been, I don't know, presumably 96, early 97, Michael Kandel, who used to edit an extremely fine set of science fiction books for Harcourt until they decided, hey, no more science fiction except for
Harcourt
Ursula Le Guin.
Yeah.
Because we can't afford to dump her. Michael Kandel discovered Cage Baker and published her first novel in the Garden of Eden in 97. In 98, but the galleys were kicking around in 97. And at that point, I was at my first job, which was an editorial assistant at what was then Avon Books, working for the extremely fine editor Jennifer Brell, and I got a galley of this book called In the Garden of Eden because they were selling paperback rights. And that was, I think, one of the first deals I ever conducted for the rights for, I think, the first three books, but they only ended up publishing two. Because I was just absolutely gobsmacked by that book. Because it managed, well, A, time traveling. I am never tired of books about time travel if it is done
They're
well.
They're timeless.
Well, sometimes. It is also a beautiful, tragic romance, which I like when it's done well.
Oh God!
Which it is. It's after the first one. It's absolutely heartbreaking.
It's a weeper.
But at the same time, there is just this wonderful air of cynicism,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, totally feeds into my snarky side. And she manages to combine all of those things.
The hunting of the snarky.
Yes, in a way that just seems so true. Jim was saying to me earlier this week that it's hard to sum up the premise of the books, which were later 8 books, The Company.
Plus countless novellas and short stories.
Yes, two short story collections, Black Projects, White Nights, and Gods and Pawns. Plus, there is a 9th book that concerns one of the main characters of the series, Edward Alton Bell Fairfax, that's coming out within the next few weeks.
She also did a fix-up of The Empress of Mars.
Oh, yes. That is true. That's also an offshoot because it takes place in the same universe. Thankfully, after...
It's a Company novel.
Yes. After Harcourt and... Avon, well then HarperCollins, declined to publish her, David Hartwell, who is often good as a picker-upper of unconsidered trifles, decided to sign her on, which was wonderful because there was a huge, huge gap between book 4 and book 5 that I personally found insupportable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if it weren't for the fact that I believe it was Golden Griffin publishing Black Projects, White Knight, or is it White Knights, Black Projects?
Whatever.
I would have gone nuts because some of the stories in there were developed into book 5, which is The Life of the World to Come.
Right.
But I guess I'm being too abstract here because I think we ought to talk about what the premise of the series
is. Well, we're going to have Cage talking about
exactly,
that for 40 minutes.
Exactly.
Let me say that I came into the series on book 3. And for no other reason than I had gotten the advanced, whatever ARC stands for,
Advanced Reader's Copy.
Advanced Reader's Copy. And I had gotten that. And I didn't know what this book was about. I hadn't heard of Cage Baker. And by the way, for all those not looking at their radios, it's Cage with a K, K-A-G-E, Baker. And just the title, Mendoza in Hollywood, and poorly written blurb, which I don't think ended up with the book itself. It was just on the arc. Made me think, oh, this is a throwaway, quick read, probably lowbrow kind of a thing. Well, the title, Mendoza in Hollywood, it could be a Kaufman and Hart science fiction romp, for all you know from that name. And I read it, and it was not what I was expecting. And I loved it. And when
being set in 1863, for example, and not, say, during the film era.
Yeah. Although being time travelers, that doesn't stop them from watching films. But you will hear all about that shortly. My point is that for me, that is perhaps my favorite book. For many other people, it's Garden of Eden. I think that the question of what your favorite Cage Baker work is probably the first one that you've read, the one that introduces you to that world, including, for example, for some people, they think her best story is Sun Observe the Time.
Oh, the Vermeer, that's the Vermeer one, isn't
this is
it?
1800, no, this is the San Francisco earthquake.
Oh, that one, oh God, that one is really powerful.
That's a fabulous
story.
That's
really powerful. And just also for the character development of Victor, who is a real tragic figure.
Yeah,
and you don't understand how tragic he is until...
Until you read the entire sweep.
Yeah, yeah.
But the thing is that you can read that story alone, and get a great deal out of it.
Yeah.
Now, as it is, we're not going to have time to play everything, so we'd probably best get started. That's assuming that we want to get in both the synopsis and the fiction, Empress of Mars, this morning. So we'll get started on the synopsis. And this was recorded between, as I recall, Mendoza and Hollywood and the Graveyard Game. Can you put a year on that?
I am not...
Not readily.
...certain. It probably around 2000, wouldn't it be?
That sounds about right. So that was Cage's first trip post-publication to New York. And every time she came, I had her on this program. So let's listen to that. We may at some point skip ahead a little in order to fit things into our time slot a little better. But because this is just talk and it's the fiction, it's sort of unassailable. So, and even there, that gets cut, but gets cut by her. So stay tuned.
First, outline the books.
Well, the first one's In the Garden of Eden, which begins the story. And it basically introduces you to the company. It follows the operative Mendoza, who's sort of the central character of the series, or one of the two. And it introduces the other one, which is her recruiter and mentor, Joseph, who's an older and wiser operative. She's a child. She... through a, you know, series of chance occurrences, winds up in the dungeons of the Inquisition, where they really did burn children, among a lot of other people. And because she's basically an unclaimed piece of baggage in time and space, is rescued by Joseph. He's intending to do her a good turn. Introduced to the company and essentially made immortal, with the understanding that in return for her immortality, she will work for the company. And after all, it's the best work in the world to be doing, you know, saving things from destruction, saving things from the terrible people, you know, the human beings who are so heedless and so careless that they destroy works of art, etc. And so she's raised with a lot of others and then sent into the field when she's 17. And she's extremely arrogant and full of her own cleverness, like most young people, but also, you know, she's an immortal cyborg with super intelligence. And they go on their first mission to England. She's accompanied by Joseph. She learns really quickly the way the world actually works.
We are now in just pre-Elizabethan time.
Pre-Elizabethan, just before Elizabeth. Elizabeth is around, but not on the throne yet. This is the reign of Bloody Mary, which was aggressively Catholic. And... it was the time in which Mary Tudor started burning Protestants. Mendoza falls in love with a Protestant, and of course, he dies. She essentially swings from despising immortals to adoring them passionately. We must do something to help these people, to completely numb emotionally at the end of the book. And she is sent on to a field station in South America. And it's sort of her coming-of-age story. You know, that's the first one is about her. And it introduces the man, the mortal man, who is a rather odd mortal man. She's drawn to him. She's fascinated by him because he's incredibly intelligent and humane and not really what you'd expect to find in a late medieval setting. But he does get burned as a heretic. And then the second book, Sky Coyote, picks up something over a century later. Joseph is being sent to the American continent because the company has a mission, rather a large one. They're going to go up to what will be California and basically collect an entire tribe of Chumash Indians. The idea being that someone in the future wants them saved, and Dr. Zeus will get anything for anyone if they pay the price and someone is willing to. And so what happens is he stops at the South American base to pick up Mendoza because she's been drafted for the expedition too. And she's gotten sort of settled in an academic situation where she has absolutely no emotional contact with anybody, and that's fine with her. But the second book mostly focuses on Joseph, who must, through a series of clever prostheses and graft appliances, is transformed into Sky Coyote, who is the sort of trickster, but benign trickster, Promethean spirit of the Chumash. And he basically goes into this pre-contact village, although he finds it's not as pre-contact as he thought it was. They have, in fact, been manufacturing baskets with the design of the flags of Spain, you know, because they've noticed them and sailing up and down the coast, and they're not exactly an ignorant people. In fact, they're not ignorant at all. They're quite savvy, and in fact have, and this is historical truth, the Chumash had a mercantile empire. They traveled extensively. They manufactured a lot of goods, and they exported them. They had a network that extended through the Channel Islands and quite a bit of the inland coast area. A Stone Age culture, but they were quintessentially Californians, you know, in many, many ways. But Joseph is sent in to persuade one tribe, which is in a remote area, to let the gods, big quotes around the word, take them off and to a glorious new future somewhere else where they will all be saved from the terrible white man who is coming to kill them all. And most of that book involves his efforts to do that. But what Joseph is beginning to discover, he doesn't have that much trouble recruiting the Indians, who know a good deal when they see it. What he does have problems with is, for the first time on this mission, because they're starting to get close to technological times, he encounters people from the 24th century, some of the actual officials of the company, and they're not exactly the all-wise masters that it was assumed. In fact, they're rather timid and stupid and bigoted and ignorant, right? And it's a little alarming to encounter the inheritors of the future and discover what they're like. So there begin to be undercurrents of something. Perhaps the company isn't quite as benign as it seems to be. And after a number of difficulties, including fighting off an emissary of the god Sheninganik, who was the deity of the first monotheistic faith, which rose independently, you know, among Native Americans, and promptly proceeded to violently convert all of its neighbors and demonize the previous gods of, or rather spirits, of the Native American tribes. And anyway, Joseph manages to deal with this threat and ships off the Chumash, and they go off happily into the future, and in the distant future become quite successful entrepreneurs. They adapt to a technological world without any problem at all. And just as a footnote, I'd like to add that the Chumash are real, do exist, are good neighbors, and in fact run a heck of a good casino in San Luis Obispo County if you're ever over there.
So they did survive.
And in fact, they've actually held on to some of their own lands, not a reservation that the United States government gave them, but lands that actually were theirs that they managed to not be thrown off of. So they're still there, although they do, you know, they're battling several lawsuits. But in any case, I drew extensively on their mythology for that book because quite a lot of it is still known. The third book, Mendoza in Hollywood, picks up Mendoza's storyline again. She's been at the end of Sky Coyote. She sort of goes off into the interior and begins work as a botanist in the wilds of California. And it was a fairly wild place, and in certain places it still is. And she has sort of gained a kind of nirvanic bliss back in the redwoods and so forth. She hasn't seen another human being in years and years for most of it. But then she's abruptly called down to Los Angeles, of all places.
Cahuenga Pass?
The Cahuenga Pass, yes. Okay. It's pronounced the Cahuenga Pass, which runs right through present-day Hollywood, which at that point didn't exist. There was a little place called La Nopalera, which means the cactus patch. And that was all there was of what is now Hollywood. However, it's interesting to note that it was a fairly rough area, and there were bandits and cowboys.
Yes, there
still are, but that goes without saying. But everything that the, you know, 30, 40 years later, the cinema pioneers were starting to imagine in those hills had actually been there before. In any case, she's sent to Los Angeles. She's sent to a stagecoach in the Cahuenga Pass. And she meets the other operatives are there. And her job is to gather a lot of rare species that are shortly to die out because Los Angeles, virtually from the time anyone can remember, has undergone cataclysm after cataclysm after cataclysm. And it was about to experience, in 1862, it was about to experience a devastating drought, which compounded by the grazing practices of the local cattle, the ranching practices, pretty much wiped out a lot of the native ecosystem. So her job is to go in and collect samples of things before it's all gone. She's stationed there with several other operatives. They're all basically cooped up in one little stagecoach stop with nobody to talk to but each other. And I had sort of planned the action to follow a little bit the theme of Grand Hotel, which is another one of the I think it's 10 themes, which is you find a hotel or a way station or a coach that's going to be on a bridge that's collapsing, you know, and you follow the individual stories of each of the characters. And so that was the structure for Mendoza in Hollywood. And you follow the fortunes and learn a little bit of the history of the other operatives. There's one that's a young operative himself. He's just starting out on his first assignment, just as Mendoza herself was, and he's naive, and he's easily wounded, and he eventually, you know, learns the painful lessons of life fairly, not as badly as Mendoza did, but painfully enough. There's an older operative.
That's the ornithologist.
Yes, Juan Batista, the ornithologist, who was an Indian child recruited from the Channel Islands before they were evacuated, and loves birds and has become an ornithologist. And there's Porfirio, who's an older operative who was born at the time of the Spanish conquest, who was in fact the child of a Spanish, was the child of a Spanish conquistador and an Indian princess, and lost both his parents fairly catastrophically, and was told by his mother just before she died to always look after his baby brother. Well, both he and his baby brother were collected by the company. He had what it took to be made immortal. His brother didn't. And so he's sort of, the child was nicely farmed off to mortal parents, but Porfirio has sort of had this injunction hanging over his head emotionally the entire time to keep track of his family. He had a brother, his brother had children, and he has followed his family, his brother's descendants, all these years and looked after them like an older brother. And if you have a family and you're in any kind of an older sibling situation, you know that is hell on earth, is trying to look after people and help them out when, you know, they bring you all their problems.
And it's a difficult thing through all these years.
Through all the centuries. Particularly when you can't let them know who you really are.
Yeah.
You have to show up, you know, and then disappear for five decades and then come back and become a benefactor to the family. And, of course, they can't know who you really are. And he's had to take, you know, ever wider forms of evasion. And shortly before the book starts, he's had a bad breakup with his family because he wound up shooting the abusive husband of his niece, or great-great-great-niece, and, of course, had to take it on the lam. And now he's pretty much in exile for a while.
Tell us a little about the anthropologist.
The anthropologist, Imarte. Imarte is a lady from old Babylon. She was a priestess of Isis, and she is an insertion anthropologist, which means that she goes into a culture and partakes of it. She does not study it from outside. She interacts with it and becomes one with it. And her role at the stagecoach stop is that of the hooker, because most extensive stagecoach stops had at least one hooker on the premises. And she goes out and she interacts with the culture of Los Angeles and
becoming the whore from Babylon.
Yes, the whore from Babylon, bringing a little bit of Babylon with her wherever she goes. And she's fascinated by anthropology, and she learns fascinating, you know, details from the gentleman that she takes to her bed, and aggressively pursues them for details about their life. And she's a bit of a, you know, a bit of a know-it-all, and a bit in the way that a lot of academics will be, very narrow-minded and very fixed on her own disciplines, and a total whore, but for academic reasons. And sententious. Mendoza and she hate each other on sight, but it's one of those cat things, you know.
It's not television movie melodrama.
No,
hate.
No,
it's
not.
It's people dislike.
It's just co-workers coexisting in an office getting along, or in this case, you know, a stagecoach stop. They engage in wars of words when they speak at all. This sort of an arrogance. But also, you know, if you get two women in the same room and one of them is dressed to perfection and the other one is dressed in working clothes, they're going to eye each other, and there's going to be an unspoken spark of bzzz, you know. But in any case. But Imardi, by and large, is simply very devoted to her job and sees absolutely nothing wrong, you know, with any of it. She doesn't share the purple passions of, say, certain vampire ethics. She simply loves her work. She loves finding out anthropological details, you know, that particularly that are unusual in a setting. She finds it fascinating. Most of the operatives live for knowledge because it's the only thing consistent in their lives. It's the only thing that can be, you know, obtained. Their own particular disciplines are for them the ultimate final comfort, partly because they're programmed that way, but also because knowledge will not desert you. I mean, mortals desert them, nations desert them. You know, they have no ethnic background of their own anymore, and everything changes, but at least learning and, you know, acquiring information and saving things can continue. So in any case, there are two others. There's Oscar, who was an interesting character to write. He's
fun.
He's an anthropologist, too, although not an insertion. He simply records. And he's based a little bit on the figure of the Wizard of Oz. And I made some, you know, prior to his ascent to Oz, insofar as he's an operative who was actually born in America. And he thinks America and the American ethic, and particularly the, you know, the Wealth of Nations strategy, is the greatest thing by gum to come down the turnpike, you know, since sliced bread. And he, as the others do, he loves his specialty. He loves acquiring information about people. But he also very much gets into the role of being a traveling salesman, the ultimate American job. And he believes in himself. He believes in the company. He believes in what he does. He has a perfect cover because he believes in his role to an extent that a lot of operatives don't accomplish. You know, Mendoza definitely has doubts about herself and certainly about the company, but Oscar has no fears whatsoever. He likes doing his job well. He'll try to sell things to people, and all the while he's got cameras rolling, recording them. But likewise, he becomes obsessed with the idea of really selling them things. Can he get people on this frontier to buy things? And most of his action in the book centers around a quest to sell the Criterion brass-bound patented pie safe, which is a wonder he is carrying around on his salesman's cart, and he can't sell it to anybody because nobody in Los Angeles made pies in 1862. It was mostly Hispanic. A pie safe, by the way, is actually just a sort of a cupboard with galvanized tin lining. But the word pie safe is such a wonderful concept. You don't see it, you know, out in California. Nobody had pie safes, and I just thought, what if he has the ultimate pie safe and he can't unload it? So most of his action devolves around a running bet that he's made with the other operatives that he can't sell it, you know. And he insists that he can sell it, and he ultimately does. But it becomes a voodoo altar. So, but that doesn't matter. He has sold it. And the last operative is a very, very old operative named Einar, who is working mostly as a zoologist, but he also has a great deal of interest in the cinema. And he is incredibly jazzed. He's delighted to be in Hollywood. Hollywood isn't there yet, but one of the things he does is takes the other operatives on tours about, look, let's go down this gulch and turn right at this dry creek bed. See that stand of cactus? That's where Paramount's going to be. And right over here is where they're going to film the Babylon scene from Intolerance. And, you know, Culver City is down that way, or will be, you know, in 100 years, or less than 100 years. And he has been an operative so long that he has outlived a lot of the despair that eventually claims a lot of them, and basically is just wildly enthusiastic in living for the moment and living for what will be. So he does his job. He doesn't worry about the company. He's just sort of, he's got the attitude of a lot of stone but terribly cheerful hippies of, this is all so cool, man. And he's happy. And Mendoza thinks he's absolutely out of his mind also, but he's always cheerful. So the five of them are together, and it follows the different plot lines. The attempted sale of the pie safe and Imardi's gradual uncovering through the men she's sleeping with of what appears to be a plot to overthrow the American government, because the Civil War has just started in the East. And while the Cahuenga Pass and what is going to be Hollywood wasn't particularly involved with the Civil War, or at least you wouldn't think so, there were rumblings on the West Coast and certain plots going on. And a lot of this, by the way, was absolutely true, did occur. The town of Visalia in Central California was, in fact, a hotbed of the Confederacy. And there was actually a plot to take the Pacific Mail by a couple of young gentlemen who were going to arm a ship and basically be privateers for the Confederacy on the West Coast. This is all a matter of fact. And Imardi begins uncovering a plot, which absolutely fascinates her. She absolutely doesn't take sides, but she just thinks this is amazing. This is a corner of history that's completely unexposed. And she's ready to rip the veil from it and expose it. And Mendoza doesn't give a damn. Mendoza's just sitting there marking time, because after she's collected her plans, she's not reassigned. So she's basically sort of hanging around and being miserable, which has pretty much become a habit with her by this time. The young ornithologist has to go through a sort of rite of passage and loses something he values very much. Porfirio plays out the drama with his family because one of his nephews comes looking for him, and there's a near tragedy that occurs. And the various different stories play out, and then Mendoza's turn comes because a man walks into her life that she really did not expect. Yes, we shouldn't go much farther on that, but she is plunged into something.
Hmm? Yeah, I think that we can say that he hails from England.
Yes, he's an Englishman.
And he's sort of a James Bond character of the early Civil War.
Right. He's the English, it's a matter of historical fact, I can say this without giving anything away of the plot, that the British and the French both shamelessly played both sides against each other to their own advantage during the Civil War. They armed the Confederacy. They gave lip service to the Union, because, of course, slavery is wrong. But they did everything they could to help the Confederacy put up a good fight.
Commerce is commerce.
You know, wool mills and cotton mills are cotton mills and wool mills. But it's also a fact that if the Union had...
And if I remember my Jane Austen, there were any number of British people who profited from slave trade.
Absolutely. It's absolutely true. You know, and then...
Terrible thing when you know your history through Jane Austen, but there it is.
But there it is. It's there. It's there, in any case. It was not lost on any of them that the West Coast was virtually unprotected in the event of the Union losing the Civil War. And at that point, nobody knew. Now, you had the French occupying Mexico, and you had the British in Canada, and the Russians are up there getting interested in stuff, too. And if there was a fire sale of the American Union, who'd get California? So, needless to say, the British, within the context of the story, the British have sent someone to see if it's possible to get a really good deal. And Mendoza goes off with him, betrays her trust, deserts her job, goes AWOL, and steals company property herself. By going off with this British gentleman. And it doesn't work out well. He does not survive the expedition, and at the end of it, she is arrested by the company and taken out of out of active service and exiled, in fact, to a place called Back Way Back. But no one knows. She's sort of stranded there on her own at an agricultural station.
Should be a lot of botany where she is.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Botany and also a lot of field work, even more, because she's the only one there. And, of course, being an immortal, she has, the responsibility. I mean, she has the strength, but also it's basically slave labor. She's growing supplies for the company. So there she is, and that's where the third book ends. But she has begun to be, she's beyond bitter about her experiences with Englishmen who keep dying. because she's noticed certain things, and she has uncovered, moreover, certain details about the company and about this Englishman's relationship to the company that are beginning to make her realize...
That are at best described, perhaps, as anachronistic.
Anachronistic. And clearly something is going on. The first book begins, Mendoza is describing, she's sitting where she's been exiled, and one of the things she says is, I'll tell you what I learned in school. And she begins to relate the history of the company. By the third book, you're beginning to realize that what she was told in school is not necessarily true, and that there are some very strange things going on.
And an event that happens in most people's lives. What age were you when you discovered what you learned in school wasn't true?
Indeed, you do, So she's sitting there. There she is. She's 150,000 years in the past, stuck on an island out in the ocean at an agricultural station. She has a lot of time to think. And that's basically where the third book ends. The fourth book is called The Graveyard Game. And it relates around an incident, which I really ought to have mentioned while I was describing Mendoza in Hollywood, that at one point she and Einar go back, they go collecting in Laurel Canyon. Now, Laurel Canyon in Los Angeles is an extremely strange place. There's a story, I think it's by his bootstraps. No, it's He Built a Crooked House by Robert Heinlein. And if I recall correctly, the way it begins is that everyone in the world blames all the craziness in the world on the Americans, and all the Americans blame it on the Californians. The Californians all say, well, it's the fault of Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And Hollywood says, no, it's not us, it's the people up in Laurel Canyon. And the people in Laurel Canyon say, it's not us, it's the people who live on Lookout Mountain Drive. They're responsible for everything weird in the world. And the company has noticed a number of what they're always calling anomalies on Star Trek connected with this one particular canyon in the Hollywood Hills. And Mendoza, because also it's got a climactic variance, there's some strange plants that grow there. Mendoza goes there to collect plants. She's warned it's a dangerous area. She takes one of the other operatives with her. She takes Einar with her. They go back there. And something happens that they don't quite understand, and they wind up...
And is against...
Is against...
Everything they've been taught.
It's against everything they've been taught, because technically...
In terms of
temporal physics, what they were always told was that you can travel back into the past, you cannot travel into the future. You can simply go back into the past and
time
back...
Time travel is one way, is the first precept that we're given.
Is the first precept that we're given. And also... something that Mendoza has begun to discover is that she apparently has a minor electromagnetic problem called the generation of Crohn's radiation, which is something that the operatives have noted. Certain mortals generate what is called Crohn's radiation, which is something they can perceive that humans, mortals can't. And it manifests to immortalize as a sort of a blue electromagnetic haze around a person. And it's most commonly manifested by someone who has apparently psychic abilities in some way or other, whether, abilities to sense the future or kinesis. And it's defined, the company studied it. It's defined as their personal electro-temporal feel is a little bit out of phase. And so they're sort of picking up, like a badly tuned radio, they're picking up other stations, as it were. But, of course, none of the immortals have it, because that's one of the things that is checked when they're being studied as small children to see if they are fit for the immortality process. Well, Mendoza is one. She's not supposed to be. Technically, there are no immortals who are Crohn generators, and she is. And so...
But it slipped in her recruiting process.
It was slipped in her. Basically, Joseph knew it, but was so desperate to get her out of the dungeons of the Inquisition that he just sort of glossed it over. He did it out of kindness, and of course it winds up causing incredible trouble for her later. Although at this point she has begun to generate it, she doesn't know why, she's not even really consciously aware of it, but the security chief, Porfirio, knows, and he tells her, watch your back. You're not supposed to be able to do this, none of us are. Well, apparently, her little ability, combined with the weirdness of Lookout Mountain Drive, create some sort of temporal anomaly, and she and her fellow operative wind up in the middle of a housing development, a very ugly one, which is really there, called Mount Olympus in the Hollywood Hills, suddenly in 1996, with their horses. And they don't know what to do because this isn't supposed to happen. The company told them this could never happen. And they frantically ride to the nearest station, which is on Zeus Drive in Mount Olympus, and sort of go in, and it is a company safe house, and they're able to be sent back, you know, from that point. But before they are, they're sort of waiting in the chamber to be sent back to their own proper time. And another operative comes into the house. Mendoza's already in the chamber. The door is shut. It's like this little radio room here, in fact. And she can see it's an operative that she knew from her South American time, operative named Lewis, and he sees her and he goes chalk white and begins to beat on the window, screaming for her, don't go with him, you know, for God's sake, don't go with him, Mendoza. She doesn't know what's wrong. You know, she looks at her fellow operatives. She doesn't understand. And it's too late. He can't get in to tell her the rest of what he means to tell her because already the time transcendence field is generated and they go zapping back. But she's sort of dismayed. But she doesn't know what to make of it. And then, of course, later it becomes obvious that he knew what was going to happen to her when she ran off with the Englishman. But it was he wasn't able to tell her in time to do anything because history cannot be changed. Well, the fourth book, Graveyard Game, picks up basically in that scene, but it's from Lewis's point of view. Lewis is on duty in Hollywood in 1996. And comes home from the studio one day where he works as a script person, which gives him an excellent opportunity to, you know, secrete away certain things that are going to be valuable later, like original scripts of, you know, first drafts of films for the company. He sees her. He realizes what's going on. He tries to warn her. He realizes he can't warn her. She's gone in a moment. She's back. And he's devastated because he knows what happened to her. He knows she was arrested. He knows she was sent back into exile and has never been seen since. And so, because he's terribly upset by this, he goes and seeks out Joseph, who is sort of her father figure, travels up to San Francisco, drives up there in one day. As Californians do, you know, think nothing of driving 300 miles, you know, in a morning. And they go together to a restaurant in Chinatown and sit down and talk about it. And Joseph doesn't know what has happened to Mendoza. And the two of them, you know, after their initial shock over what has happened, sort of swear a pact that they're going to try and find out what happened to her if they can, and rescue her if they can. The book takes, I think, a couple of centuries to act out because they can only act in minor ways, but it's sort of a buddy movie.
Yeah, and it's unusual in that each other book mm-hmm. is a slice of life. Well, the first book, of course, starts with the recruiting of Mendoza, her training, and then her assignment.
Mm-hmm.
But if we regard the main events of that book as from when she starts her assignment,
mm-hmm.
and the others, all the others take place within a relatively small period of time. The Graveyard Game spans a couple of centuries.
Yeah, and it also zips back into the past because there's some reminiscences, some flashbacks, because Joseph is an old, old operative. He's been in the field for, 20,000 years. And he's done just about everything interesting that you can do. He, you know, fought as a Roman soldier. And Joseph is carrying around his own particular bag of guilt and angst because back at the dawn of time, the company had two kinds of immortals. They had the preservers who, you know, would look like you or I and basically run around doing the fairly nice, benign, collecting rare books that are going to be burned when libraries, you know, catch fire or saving children who are going to die, you know,
and
needlessly.
They're benevolent reactors.
Yeah, they're benevolent reactors. But the company realized shortly after it made them that they needed something a bit more. because at the dawn of time, it was a little difficult to collect any material culture when tribes were slaughtering each other so violently that material culture didn't have time to begin to be developed. In particular, there was what Mendoza refers to in the first book as the Great Goat Cult, which were apparently a very, very early sect of fanatics who felt that their god was right, everyone else was an infidel, and should be slaughtered.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
We saw some people like that today.
Yes, well, the concept, you know. Try and understand this for a moment, folks.
Yes.
People actually did this in the Stone Age. But civilized people don't do that.
No,
of course.
No,
yes.
Not at all.
But in any case, no, couldn't happen. But in any case, and the company got a little tired of sitting around waiting for these people to shape up and learn better, and finally realized if we don't make civilization happen, if we don't bring, you know, get rid of these people, nobody's going to. So they invented another kind of operative, immortal, as the preservers were. Brilliant, you know, augmented intelligence, but absolutely impervious to fear, pain, and quite happy to commit violence. However,
they're programmed that way.
Not bad guys, just extremely zealous with the truth with which they were programmed, which is it is their duty to bring peace to humanity by making sure that nobody makes war. They're righteous, they're zealous, they're absolutely pure, and they're very, very big. And they were designed...
They're not Homo sapiens.
No, they're not Homo sapiens. They were a hybrid breeding experiment to produce basically a very, very large morphology that would be useful in a combat situation. The sort of flattened head and long skull that the Neanderthals had, but a big and long body. And, of course, they're augmented, so they're immortal. Fairly quickly, they solved the company's problem, and then the company realized, we have 3,000 giant soldiers on our hands, and now they're beginning to ask us how righteous we are, and maybe we should do something about them. And essentially, one of them, because they're like machines, they're unstoppable, they have a purpose, they have to fulfill the purpose, they very quickly began to see that without war to stop, what was their place? And one of them rebelled and essentially said, well, you can't trust any of the mortals. You know, if you take us out now, look what's going to happen. Look at the course of human history that we know is going to occur, because, of course, they're all taught, you know, the history of the ages to come. Why not take us off the job? Or rather, you know, why not, instead of taking us off the job, let us continue doing our work, and we can change history, and we can make it better. We will make sure that it is always a golden age, and no one will ever commit war, which, of course, can't happen. And he does lead a rebellion, and he starts going after potential criminals among the mortals that are currently around. And, you know, it gets ugly, and so the company realizes they have a problem. So they figure out a way to retire the enforcers, which is what the big guys are called. And this is not entirely a good thing, because they have to lie to them to do it. And they come up with a way, which is gradually revealed in the course of the books, of tricking them into being retired in a big way. And Joseph doesn't really know that this is going on. It's been kept a secret from most of the older operatives, because a lot of them feel very indebted to the enforcers. Joseph himself was recruited by an enforcer named Budu, who was sort of their grand general. He was a member of a peaceful cave-dwelling tribe somewhere in the Basque region. You know, his people drew horses on walls and did stuff like that, but the Great Goat Cult felt that anyone drawing pictures on walls was an abomination, and so they sailed in and massacred his family and almost himself, but at the last minute, you know, were descended on by the enforcers, and so he was rescued. So he's always looked on Budu as a sort of a father figure. And Joseph is very politically savvy and fairly amoral, but he does feel guilty, you know, as he realizes that the old guys kind of face a difficult situation, and he kind of guiltily realizes that they're going, something is going to happen, and they're going to be retired by the company, but he doesn't really do anything about it, because it's not his job. But at one point, it's related, in Sky Coyote, he did encounter Budu, apparently on his way to a court-martial, and Budu downloaded, you know, had 5 minutes along with him, downloaded a bit of information, and said, here, you know, I'm going to be going underground. Access this when you dare if you want to find out what happened to the old enforcers. And Joseph has basically shunted the information. He has not opened the file. He shunted it to the back of his memory for years and years and years and not opened it. So flash forward several centuries into the future, and he and Joseph, Joseph and Lewis, realize, boy, you know, the company has not actually played fair with a lot of us, and a lot of us are beginning to disappear the closer we get, you know, into the their end of time, the 24th century, which is where the company resides. And also, at this point, it becomes really painfully evident that there is something terribly wrong about the year 2355. All of the operatives have noticed that although they, as children in the Stone Age or the Renaissance or whenever they were recruited, when they were educated in the past, in the context of the past, they were given all the wealth of the future. They were given Jane Austen novels and George Lucas films and all of the popular culture of the centuries to come, and given this incredibly rich heritage of things. But gradually, over the years, one after another, have gradually realized that not one thing they have been given dates past the year 2355. There are no books from past that year, no films, no music, nothing. Everything they've been given as, this is the heritage of the future, these are the songs, the dances, the life, dates from before that point. And, of course, many of them have asked, what happens after 2355? And the company said, oh, well, we don't give you anything after that because that's the year in which the company can finally go public. We can let everyone know what a wonderful job you'll be doing. You'll be free to live among us and take your rightful place as, you know, a grateful handshake. And you'll be able to discover all the art and literature after that time for yourself. So we don't give you any. And, of course, none of the immortals believe that for a minute. They know something's going to happen in the year 2355. And through investigation, they gradually discovered that the company doesn't know either, that apparently they receive no transmissions from them their future selves beyond that date. There is a rumor amongst operatives that the last transmission dates from July 9th at 11 o'clock in the morning Pacific Standard Time, 2355, and it says simply, we still don't know, and then breaks off. And Joseph is terribly afraid that as they near that year, you know, as they get past the 20th century and into the next couple of centuries, that something is going to start happening. It's already been noticed that operatives sometimes disappear and are never seen again.
Such as Mendoza.
You know, Mendoza disappears, but others have also, that there are, and what has happened to the old enforcers? And when they get to the year 2355, do they have any guarantee that the company is actually going to welcome them into their hearts, their homes, etc.? You know, move into our neighborhoods, please. We love you. Yes, you're Superman. You're incredibly smart. You know, you make us look like ants, but we'll have you in our neighborhoods. So are we okay?
Yeah, we're fine.
Okay. In any case, he and Lewis sort of compare notes uneasily and realize we have to be extremely careful, because if we're caught, we too might disappear. And they're an odd couple pairing, because Lewis is a little dapper, witty, sort of brittle fellow who's a little bit feckless. He's a hopeless romantic and a sentimentalist and just sort of the nicest
saying, okay. He's chronically unhappy in love.
Lewis is chronically unhappy in love. He loves Mendoza from afar. And has never, ever pressed his suit because he knows how miserably unhappy she was and how she is still in love with a mortal man that she loved and lost. And he would never press his advantage because he is a perfect general and gentleman and a chivalrous knight and all the rest of it. And a little bit sort of, you know, he has a sort of Niles Crane intensity of feeling, and is a hopeless romantic. Joseph is a pragmatic, slightly immoral fellow. He's a trickster. He's Coyote, basically. And
known as a facilitator.
Facilitator. And the facilitators are, they're not involved in collecting things to be saved. They're not botanists or anthropologists or literature specialists. They deal with politics. They make things happen for the other operatives, and they play with human governments, and they're always the man who's right there to, you know,
make sure that the conditions are what the company needs
right,
them to be.
Right. I think at one point Joseph says something about, you know, to hand the, just be standing there helpfully at His Holiness's elbow to give him that mot juste when he's writing that encyclical, or to remind the senator where he left his pants, or to leave that script where Mr. Spielberg can see it. You know, just right there to just sort of nudge history along. Not change it by any means, but just make sure that when it happens to the company's advantage, which is the whole way in which the company makes its money. And he's a little short, dark, bearded guy and fairly, you know, brusque in his attitude. So there's a sort of an interesting odd couple. And one of the first things Joseph says is, Lewis, you're a literature specialist. If there's anything dangerous needs to be doing, let me do it. You stay out of it. I'll let you know when I find Mendoza, but, you know, don't get into trouble, because he knows Lewis is hopeless at stuff like this. Lewis is a brilliant, I mean, he's an immortal, and he's brilliant, and he's also, you know, they're people. The thing is, the immortals are people, and they're as varied as people are, in any case. So Joseph realizes on his own that if he has to go up against the company, and if he has to dig around in some places he's not supposed to dig around, maybe he should go to Boodoo. Maybe he needs to go to his old father figure and see if he can find him, because it would be useful to have Boodoo's help. And there's one other person who might be able to help him, who is the North American or North African head facilitator, Suleiman. And Suleiman is an extremely old and extremely powerful operative who basically runs the North African operation for the company. And he's a very good man also. He's one of those that has not played for personal power for his own benefit, but because he genuinely wants to help humanity. And he's perfectly well aware that the company has started, you know, perhaps was always a bit more interested in its own profit than in actually helping humanity. And he's countered by building up a power base of his own. He's been, for example, extremely concerned about the incredibly high incidence of communicable diseases and plagues that have arisen in Africa. And he, through investigation, he discovers that the company is responsible somehow. Someone within the company is doing this. So he's on his own investigative plot. Anyway, Joseph realizes it's either going to be Suleiman or Boodoo that he needs to go to, and he can't find Boodoo. At this point, he finally screws up his courage and opens the file that Boodoo had downloaded to him, you know, 10 centuries earlier. And what it is it's a code. It's a list of locations where the company has bunkers in which the old enforcers are stashed, and some other people as well. And he realizes, oh, my gosh, this is where the disappeared people have been sent, or at least he thinks this is where it is. So he realizes Boodoo has either gone underground and gone rogue, in which case he's going to be very, very difficult to find, or, which he thinks is more likely, Boodoo is probably in one of these bunkers, and Mendoza may well be too. So he sort of sets off on a personal quest to try and locate them. And the first thing he does is he goes to kind of backtrack and find out the truth of what happened to Mendoza in 1862. And he interviews, he tracks down Porfirio in Texas, and there's a scene set there on Halloween night where they talk. And they track down Juan Batista, who's, you know, in living north of San Francisco, and they interview various people. And that's when Joseph begins to realize this is way too dangerous for Lewis and says, you know, go back to England and stay there, you know, and I'll contact you. And then the centuries begin to roll by. Joseph is on his quest privately, but Lewis begins to go on a quest of his own. He begins investigating, in his way, what he can find of what happened to Mendoza. Why did she disappear? What happened to them? Because neither one of them, you know the details of what happened in the Mendoza and Hollywood book, because it was hushed up, and also Mendoza was alone with the Englishman when it happened. So there's a great deal of mystery. And Lewis begins to uncover a lot of classified information. Well, yes. He begins to probe places he shouldn't probe. He finds out a lot of information, and unfortunately in doing so, he begins to draw attention to himself, and the company begins to set a trap. It plays out, you know, over several hundred years. There's a point where Joseph comes to England, and the two of them, Joseph and Lewis, go to a place in Yorkshire and find a bunker under one of the mountains in Yorkshire. And Joseph just incidentally, I mean, he makes the connection because this is the place where he watched the 9th Hispania Legion, the famous Lost Legion, pretty much chop to pieces, including a platoon of enforcers who were there at the time. And, of course, they weren't killed, but they were chopped to pieces, basically, and they were taken off. They were collected, and the company told them, well, they'll be taken off to a repair facility, and they'll be fine. But he never saw them again. And Joseph realizes, my God, it was right here that it happened, and the bunker's right over there. And they break into the bunker, and they find rows and rows and rows of regeneration tanks where the enforcers and a bunch of other people are, but not everybody. And Joseph is, for the first time, has to sit down and realize, oh my God, all these years, you know, the company has been lying to us. You know, maybe this is what we have in store if we're lucky. And he really realizes, oh, we're in trouble now, you know, because we've seen this, and if anyone finds this out, we are really in deep. And so again, he cautions Lewis, don't get involved in this any further, stay out of it. And I don't think we can help Mendoza, by the way. It's going to be all we can do now to stay alive. So they sort of go on quest. Lewis becomes obsessed with finding out more about the Englishman. He basically reaches this chivalric, hyper-chivalric state where he realizes he can't ever have her because she loves this other man, but he focuses all his energy on, you know, the hope that someday, perhaps, you know, or in some way, wherever she is, she has been reunited with him. And he begins to write. He's a literature specialist, but he's a lousy writer. Nonetheless, he begins to sort of write down his fantasy, and he writes over the years this awful, awful, like 30-volume history of the heroic Englishman, and it sort of becomes his private Aubrey Maturin series, which are, by the way, wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Lewis is sort of like the really awful version of it. And he knows they're awful. And he knows he's a bad romantic writer. But it's the only thing in his life that brings him any joy, because gradually, as the operatives do begin, as the future progresses, and this book starts going into the future, it ends, I think, in the year 2176, they begin realizing that the company has less and less for them to do, and more of them are beginning to disappear. And it's becoming painfully obvious that what is going to happen is that when there isn't anything more for them to save, you know, probably they're all going to be retired somehow in some unpleasant way. But he clings to this fantasy that he's spinning, and also begins to walk into a trap that the company begins to lay for him, because they start feeding his interest in what happened to the Englishman. And he uncovers the fact that there appeared to be a Victorian society that seems to have been the company in the time of Queen Victoria, and that evidently this English spy was a member of it, and it seems to have given birth to the company in the future. And he uncovers, you know, what may be some evidence that there is something that the company wanted that is somehow connected with Mendoza on Catalina Island, which is a little holiday island 26 miles across the sea from California's coast. And he finally talks Joseph into going there with him. And the two of them walk into a trap, and Joseph makes it out of the trap and Lewis doesn't, essentially. And
I think we're getting to a point where we should allow a certain amount of discovery.
Yes.
For readers.
Right, right. And you can edit this.
And in fact, I'm thinking of doing just that. I'm thinking of having two versions.
Okay.
The unexpurgated spoilers and all. Here's your summation of the whole thing and the condensed teaser.
But we've already
given them a full hour.
Yeah.
Of synopsis.
So we can go on.
We can go on. So there are, from here, two books. Mm-hmm. We haven't even discussed the short stories, and we'll get back to that. But there are two books that you can be doing next.
Yes, I have. There have been, through the stories, two plot lines, essentially, which is Joseph and the politics of the company and what is going to happen in the year 2355. And Mendoza's really bad love life, her totally disastrous love life, and how they are interconnected. You know, who is this man that she loves who keeps throwing her life into disaster? Why does he keep recurring? And at the moment we've had, you know, the first one follows Mendoza, the second one, Sky Coyote, is Joseph. Mendoza in Hollywood, back to Mendoza, and the Graveyard Game is more the politics. And now we're at halftime. There's going to be a collection of short stories coming out this year.
Which sort of interweave.
It sort of interweaves, and it's going to give the alert reader quite a lot of clues about what comes next.
Yeah, yeah. When I haven't read too many of the short stories, because up till now they've all been in magazines, and I haven't gotten all the magazines. Some of them are on Fiction-Wise, which is a internet resource. But as they weave through, yeah, there are a lot of interesting clues about benevolence or lack thereof of certain forces.
And who's running the company?
Mm-hmm.
Who is really running the company? Is it the Mortal Masters, who are a bunch of science geeks and math nerds, who are brilliant at what they do, but not very savvy in the ways of the world.
And certainly not very moral.
Certainly not moral. But moral,
they think they are.
They're immoral in a passive, self-righteous kind of a way.
Yeah.
They don't, they wouldn't, you know, would not eat meat because it's bad, but, you know, they will find some sort of rationalization around doing away with someone who's inconvenient. So they're weak and immoral in a particularly politically incorrect or politically correct kind of a way, or is it the immortals? But who among the immortals?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are different groups among
Could
the immortals.
Could there be other power bases?
Could there be other power bases? Is there a real Dr. Zeus? You know, is it an agent we have not yet, you know, been introduced to? What's going on? And
so do you know which novel you will go toward after the short stories?
There are two. There's two. One of them picks up Mendoza's immediate theme, and it picks up right, you know, on Catalina Island and proceeds from there fairly rapidly and moves into the future. And it's called The Life of the World to Come. At least that's what the working title is. The other book follows the political theme. And it's called The Children of the Company. And it incorporates some of the short stories and longer stories. It incorporates and expands upon the novella Sun Observe the Time. It introduces you to a new character who may be one of the people responsible for it all.
Mm-hmm.
And it presents some of the short stories that have appeared in the past, but in a certain context, which should enable you to draw some conclusions. Anyway. So one or the other may come first. Guide me, you know, I can take guidance. Okay.
We are rolling.
So in any case, the one that follows Mendoza's adventures and what happens next is The Life of the World to Come. At least that's what we're calling it now. The other one is called The Children of the Company. And both of them are going to give you a lot more idea of what's going to happen as we get toward 2355. And Sun Observe the Time is sort of the centerpiece of The Children of the Company, although there's a tremendous amount of new material also, but it's sort of expanded upon, because what happens to Budu is one of the crucial questions in the story. Right. What has happened to Budu? Where is he, and what's going to happen? So that's where we're at the moment.
As you came from Walsingham, from that holy land, there met you not with my true love, we've got none on either hand. He set her on a milk-white steed, himself upon a gray. She picked herself a grave. She died a pure and virgin lass, for he slew her youth, the knave.
Miserere dore, miserere dore, fa sola di da. Hit hocus pocus, ha ha ha.
Take that lady bright, or William bid you sing. Behold her lofty angel flight, to earth's God and Christ the King.
Peter Schickele with the Academy Award winning Linda Hunt and Brooks Jones and Emmanuel Axe is in there playing piano. I mean, it was a heck of a concert. The Free Music Store The WBAI Free Music Store from 1976, December 12th, 1976, produced by, me. I was pretty proud of that, and definitely a high point in memories. So that was from Schickele's rendition of The Night That's Knight of the Burning Pestle by Beaumont and Fletcher, written in 1602. It was a little the music Schickele wrote more recently than the play.
It's the sort of thing that Mendoza and her friends would have been able to hear on immortal radio.
Exactly. Yes, very much so, with all the anachronisms galore. This is, speaking of anachronisms galore, this is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. The program is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. With me this morning, Amy Goldschlager, and we are memorializing or tributing, or whatever the verb here is, Cage Baker, who you heard just a brief synopsis of the beginning, about the, I'd say, the first three fifths, all told. Well, three and a half eighths, how's that?
Yeah, I mean, she gets into all the way to book four, mentioning book five and book six.
Of the series called The Company, which this is Cage Baker, K-A-G-E, Baker, with a series that began with In the Garden of Eden, I-D-E-N, and went for an innumerable number of short stories and novellas, at least two collections, but there are also individual selections and some still to come out. And that was, I didn't find out exactly when that was recorded, but we're figuring somewhere between 2000 and 2002, given where we were, and in the publication history. And Cage died, I guess at this point, about 6 weeks ago.
January 31st.
Okay. I think it was
age 57, not 58, but I could be wrong. But I'm of the firm opinion that she would have had at least 10 more books in her, and I personally feel robbed.
She was writing another series, but she was never going to stop writing The Company. There are apparent gaps, but now let me say what we're going to do this morning. We do not have time to play Empress of Mars. The question is, which would we truncate? I actually have three very long pieces that if we were to do all three, we would barely fit it into a 3.5-hour show without any commentary. And since we want to talk a bit about Cage and her writing and take calls and all that, we decided the core of what we've got, the core, really was that synopsis. And I think that if you have to choose one of those three things to explain to people who don't know Cage Baker's work, since she was a fine but not best-selling writer, I think that was the appropriate one. And with luck elsewhere, later in the year, we may play Empress of Mars. I may find a way of getting it online and just telling you all how you can listen to it and take it from there. But if you are unfamiliar with this series,
many people are. I don't understand why she remained so below the radar. I think that's a real crime.
Yeah, it's really sad. It's she was not well awarded, nominated a few times. She was, you know, one of those connoisseur things. People within the writing community and the well-read speculative fiction community know her work. But, I mean, among other things, it hurt that her publisher dropped her because they dropped all of their science fiction at one point. And it was very hard.
Both of her publishers dropped her because, as they say, I think if I remember correctly, Avon was supposed to publish Mendoza and Hollywood in paperback, and that didn't happen.
Yeah, did that ever come out in paperback? Ever?
Tor, I think, reissued all of the earlier books, with new covers, which personally I don't care for. The one thing that I liked that Avon did is I think it was J.K. Potter covers for the first two, and I thought they were great.
Mm-hmm. So, all these things conspired to not give her everything she deserved. I mean, listening at home to that synopsis, listening to the premise, how well worked out these characters are, and it gets better by, I'm not sure that book eight, the finale of the main storyline, is necessarily the high point in the entire series, but it brings it to an arc, and being time travel, of course, it circles in upon itself in so many different ways.
There are
ways.
Many transcendent moments, although there are other points in that book where I was, what?
But there are. I would say it's like looking at a concentric circle and saying, which is the high point here? You can't. There are many notable things in there, but at any rate, listening at home and listening to the synopsis, the wealth and richness, and knowing personally that this has been pitched around Hollywood at almost every studio and television producer out there, why this hasn't gotten picked up and a lot of, frankly, junk, perhaps some good things. We note that George Martin has a sale with not my favorite of his works, but certainly his best-sellingest work. I like his science fiction.
I happen to be very fond of A Song of Ice and Fire.
My problem with it is I started reading it, and by the third or fourth gory decapitation within 20 pages, I said, this isn't, what puts me happily to bed at night.
Well, perhaps not, but I don't actually think that that's his point, really.
Well, it may not be his point, but it took away from my reading experience, and so I didn't read it.
But one of the things that he does... and it's so hard for him to do he actually keeps control of every one of his threads, and it's very important about maintaining continuity, and that's something that Cage Baker did wonderfully. Jim and I were talking during this synopsis briefly about the way that Cage Baker was so good at establishing from point one little details which make sense later. I mean, there's a whole business of where you have, Nicholas and Edward and Alec, and there are these three aspects of something, and there's something not quite right about these three men who are in some ways the same man. And if you go back to book one, if you go back to the descriptions in the Garden of Eden, the way that she describes him physically and the things that he does, she's established that from the very beginning, because you have no real way of knowing from book one that he isn't a man of his time.
As it were, yeah.
As it were, yes. And the more you go back, once you understand how much the company has interfered in those three men's lives, which you didn't quite realize, and you realize that she's established that all along.
Yeah, I mean, given right from the beginning that what we know about the company is that they're actually, taking a child, they're responsible for the taking of a child away from death, sure death, at the hands of the Spanish Inquisition, making her immortal so that she can be a botanist and preserve plants. What could be the evil agenda in this? And the way that one of the things Amy and I were talking about is you take a look at a lot of series, and this is so especially true of visual media, of television ongoing series, where it doesn't matter whether it's J.J. Abrams or Joss Whedon or whoever, they change course in midstream so many times and drop character lines, add lines, say, oh, no, that isn't what we intended to begin with. We're going to do it this way instead, with Cage Baker, as Amy was saying, those hints are dropped in the beginning, and later on, something may be published 8 years later, there's the payoff, and there's the proof. And if you reread everything from the beginning, it hangs together so perfectly
well. Her mythology as a whole, you know, it doesn't become so encrusted it collapses in on itself. She doesn't, you know, gratuitously introduce things which don't become fulfilled.
Yeah. She may not have known how many books there would be and how many stories at the time that we recorded that interview, but she knew what those stories were.
Although, if you really start to think about the series and the paradoxes involved, you could get a serious headache as to how the company was created, because one of the things that you only really understand in the later set of books is just how, if not maybe stupid, how ignorant the people of the future are.
Oh, yeah.
I would so totally not want to live in 2355, where there are these people, and some of them are geniuses, but a lot of them can't read.
Mm-hmm.
But they really don't have any context of understanding their world and how they got there and how to function in it if there weren't, I don't know, computers and other things to tell them what to do.
Well, exactly.
And yet here is this incredibly well-designed company with this sinister plan, which is why you get there and you say, who's really controlling things? And you realize that the immortals are pulling the strings, and yet supposedly the company was founded by mortals, except maybe it was the immortals
posing,
making it happen. And then there's, you know, this whole business about Catalina Island and this other race of people. It gets very, very complicated, and possibly even alien technology, which is hinted at in the series of books, but is also more explicitly laid out in a short story, Lemuria Will Rise.
Yeah, there are a number of things. And of course, Cage was also a very, if you'll pardon the expression, a cagey writer. She understood the commercial aspect and the realistic aspect of, as she was forced to, having been dropped by publishers, of dealing with publishers and knowing certain things may or may not ever see the light of day, and contract fulfillment, what would the publishers do for her, and vice versa. So what one can read into that is the idea that she could have taken that series to a whole other world at some point with that alien, oh, here's a little portal, you know, basically spinoff. The potential is there, and she knew it.
And she was already starting to spin it off, because Empress of Mars is set in that world, but it actually isn't really about the company, except as much as the company was behind how Mars was settled and various important events that happened.
Yeah, that could actually have been sort of a gateway story between two different series, if she so chose. The outer space stories versus the Earth-bound stories.
And we never really find out that much about what happens on the moon, for example.
Yeah.
When there's clearly a colony there as well.
Yeah. Let me say, by the way, that one of the people whose writing in so many ways resembles Cage's, except it's more fantasy-based, although, of course, Cage also had the fantasy series going on, which began with the Anvil
of the World.
The Anvil of the World, and then continued in the House of the Stag.
And there was also some short stories that were published in Mother Egypt, which actually also has some company stories. In fact,
yeah,
the title story.
But I'm talking about her fantasy.
Yes, but she had three Lord Erminware stories.
And I'm not talking about Cage. The person who it most closely resembles in so many ways is Richard Bowes, a constant visitor to this program, he wrote an introduction for her. She wrote an introduction for him. They were very similar in terms of their craft and their discipline as writers, I would say, in terms of knowing exactly how all these things fit together in a grand weave. Rick calls them mosaic works. I like the idea of a grand weave in the contra dancing sense.
Well, I mean, I think I would agree with you. There's definitely a similar feel. And, of course, you know, Rick's mosaic novel is from the files of the Time Rangers, which is
or
also
from the
about...
tiles of the Fine Rangers.
Yes. Uh-huh.
I think that's a...
which...
Rick, are you listening? Are you...
also pulls in people from different eras, and yet it's all one transcendent whole. And of course, in his case, it's also, you know, various timelines and, you know, various universes, which is a different way of looking at it than Cage had, because she basically had one timeline in which you really couldn't change history, or at least not recorded history.
Yeah, and there are interesting things going on. As you heard in this synopsis, we get very much into the point that at that point in the books, time can only travel in one direction. It is still the concept. Time is a river and can only go one way. Nobody had actually successfully proven to go backward in time, the way that the future communicates with the past. I don't remember. How is that accomplished?
Wait, no. There was a thing called the time transcendence field. You could go backward, but the point was that you couldn't go forward.
That was it.
Which
that
is why nobody quite knew what was going to happen in July 2355.
Right. So they're not Time Lords, okay?
Except...
if you want Time Lords, tune in 2 weeks. But
except that then there is a thing where... some people discover the ability to go forward, and that's actually...
But at the point when this interview was recorded, I said to her, oh, people can't do that. And she said, not so far as you know.
Well, Mendoza in Hollywood, in fact, opens up the possibility.
The possibility, but it doesn't actually...
Yes, it does actually happen in Mendoza in Hollywood, which is like that whole... business when she and Einar are in the canyon, and the whole thing about is Mendoza is got, you know, she's a chrome generator.
Yes.
And then they actually end up in 1996 when they were originally in 1863. But the idea that someone could do it under controlled circumstances was believed not
that,
to be
right,
possible.
Yes.
That's really the fact. The possibility. That,
that's
of directing
right. Because
it.
Yeah, because there is that. You're absolutely right. There is that incident, but you see that incident doesn't really pay off as much until later, and that all turns out to be so crucial. And this was again how. When does she actually pay that off? It keeps coming
she
back.
She actually
doesn't
pays it?
It
off
in
Graveyard
Game, yeah,
in which it,
to
in
an
which
extent,
they
yeah.
really, you know. Make that incident really important in
right,
the sense
but
of
then,
they're afraid of her, of the many things, they're afraid of Mendoza for many reasons, but one of them is that she opens up the possibility of moving forward in time, and that means that she could gain some insight into the evil plans that many people have, and have insight into what happens after what they call the silence, which is, you know, this date in July 2355, they have this thing called the temporal concordance, which tells them basically all the events in history up to that point. And after that, they have nothing, and nobody knows why. And obviously, if you knew, then you would have advantage over all of these factions in the company.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Because here you have all of these people and they can't die. And they're preserving stuff up until that point. And if that's, you know, the end point of the company, well, what are you doing with all of these immortals who can't die and who are frankly smarter than you and better educated than you?
Yeah, you know, you notice, by the way, it just occurs to me as we're talking about and mentioning Time Lords, there is a certain aspect to that immortality thing that does more or less occur at one point in Cardiff. The fact that Jack Harkness cannot die, but what they do in order to try to prevent him from being capable of functioning. While he is not a Time Lord, he is an immortal who is using similar techniques. And it occurs to me that there are some similarities in Children of Earth by Russell Davies, the third season of Torchwood, that seem like, I wouldn't say they're taken from Cagebaker, but I would say that he probably read and enjoyed those books.
And I think there's certainly that same feeling of tragedy. And I think that actually infuses all of Torchwood, because when Harkness is a character in Doctor Who, he's this totally like lighthearted, fun-loving person. And then, of course, Torchwood comes along and you're like, oh, my God, when did Captain Jack become such a buzzkill?
So dark, yeah, really.
And then you discover, like, how long he's been kicking around in the past.
But at the end of time, he ends up with that lovely werewolf from another universe, so.
Yeah, but he can't die, and he's watching everybody else do it, and it's quite tragic.
It is. It is. We have about 5 minutes of talk time left. And if you'd like to call up and speak with Amy Goldschlager or myself about Cagebaker, and that is the topic at hand this morning, the telephone number is 212-209-2900. And again, on topic only. No leeway with this little time left. And let me again mention briefly that next week my guest on this program will be Nora Jemison, and N.K. Jemison, who will be discussing The 100,000 Kingdoms, her new novel, and also her Nebula Award-nominated short story. And the week after that, Chicks, Who Dig Time Lords, speaking of Torchwood and all that good stuff. Good morning. You're on the radio.
Yes. I'm Tom from the Bronx here. Lou?
Yeah?
Yeah. I'd like to say that parts of this lady's writings, I think that parts of those should be made into movies.
Oh, absolutely.
In other words, the ones about the Indians, I think.
Yeah, Sky Coyote would actually in some ways be a very good entry level for movies. It would sort of be hard to come in on the first novel, In the Garden of Eden. But Sky Coyote, and I think you're right, Sky Coyote in many ways would work sort of as an entry level and standalone.
Yeah, well, in other words, to take and the other parts of the movies, I think a little her writing, I believe, are a little too heavy. In other words, I think they would have to be scaled down for a movie.
Well, I mean, everything gets adapted. In different
ways. Well, in other
words,
if it's scaled down, if you know what I mean. In other words, instead of following all the aspects of...
Yeah, you couldn't have that many characters that far flung.
Yeah, because you know what? It's very deep, and maybe that's where she lost some of the readers.
Oh, I'm not sure that she did lose the readers, but it does happen from the first three books.
Well, I said some of them, maybe.
Don't know.
Turned off with too many details.
I don't think
right
so.
Or wrong.
I don't think so. I mean, God help us look at Lost, which doesn't really have the cohesiveness.
And they've promised not to tie it up even.
No, because they can't. There are, somebody once plotted out in the New York Times that there were over 70 something storylines in Lost.
I think some people really are just built to appreciate complex mythologies, and I think if you even just read the first book, you're signing on to something.
Okay, sounds good.
Yeah, but I mean, I agree with you. It would need, you know, some
revision.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Oh, you have to do that.
You have to do that. Yeah. I don't agree that one must lose, shall we say, Sharky's End, but I can understand why Tom Bombadil didn't make an appearance, if you know what I'm saying.
Is this lady deceased now?
Yeah, she died 6 weeks ago.
Oh, she died 6 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, well,
at age 57 or 8.
Oh, yeah, well, she was very well educated, you
Oh, yes. She taught, get this, she taught Elizabethan English as a second language.
And where was that?
Oh, in California, Pismo Beach.
That's called Elizabethan English?
Well, it was sort of a gag kind of, it was an adult, continuing adult education class. It wasn't a certified class. But this is something she did. She also worked, she was very well known in the circle of medieval fairs and things like that.
Oh, well, too bad. She should have been in the movies.
Her parents were, and her aunt and uncle were Ann Jeffries and Robert Serling of Topper. And
oh, really?
Yes.
I remember them.
Yeah, and, you know, sad, not sad for them, but it's a bizarre thing to think that they've survived her.
Yeah, isn't that something, my God?
Yeah.
What was it, cancer she...
Yeah, stomach cancer was uterine cancer.
Yeah.
Uterine cancer.
Well,
horrible.
When things are going to happen, they happen like firestorms.
Yeah, it seems that way.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for calling.
All right, thanks for listening.
Okay, have a good morning.
Right.
Okay, bye bye. I'll try to sneak in another call. Good morning. You're on the radio. Hi there.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, I think it's not a, maybe I'm looking forward to reading these company novels.
Mm-hmm.
Just heard about them a few weeks ago. And now I got really have my interest up. But I think maybe it's not the best thing to wish for our favorite books to be made into movies.
Yeah,
the movies are always going to be disappointing. So maybe,
almost always, yeah.
Yeah, so maybe I mean on the one hand it gets more people interested and then they read the book. Like what happened with The Lord of the Rings, but they almost always seem to not meet our expectations. But I wanted to, just from the description I heard, I wanted to draw a couple comparisons. I think of similar writers. One writer that seems very similar to Cage of Acres seems like Julian May.
Yes.
Because she also writes time travel books that have, like, sort of interesting loops and kind of plots that fold in on themselves.
Yeah, the intervention does that very well. Yeah,
and
yeah.
Also that
I
idea,
hadn't thought of that. I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah, that, also that idea of the guardians of time. There was a Isaac Asimov book in the late 50s called The End of Eternity.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of people think it's one of his better books. And it concerns this group of they consider themselves to be the guardians of time. And they have history all mapped out. And they sort of make, every once in a while, they make a small intervention to make, life a little better. But basically, it's a dead end. And all life, eventually, all human life ends. There's a point past which they can't go.
Yeah.
Very similar to this, to the Cage Baker scenario.
Yeah, it's a good point. Speaking of Guardians of Time, we have about 30 seconds left.
Hey, excellent show.
Thank you so much. Take care. Bye-bye. Whoops. And where am I? Doing three things at once. We only got to do, like, you know, a tiny little portion of what we would have liked. But, and this won't be the last Cage Baker show I do. Promise. And won't be the last show with Amy Goldschlager.
Well, I hope so.
Okay, very good. So thank you all for listening. Visit ourwolf.com for other things, or I'm sort of dormant on Facebook at the moment, but you can always check there, and I even have a Twitter feed. And a buzz. So thank you all for listening. I'll be back next week with N.K. Jemisin. And in the meantime, take good care and have a wonderful week. Good morning.
Hi, I'm Ken Gale, a host of Ecologic, one of WBAI's Tuesday morning environmental programs. My activism began with birds, and next Tuesday I'm proud to present David Sibley, whose nature guides are doing that for the next generation. Join us this Tuesday, March 9th at 11 a.m. here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
You are tuned to WBAI FM 99.5 on your radio dial here in New York City. And the time is now 7 o'clock. Time once again for As I Please for this, the 6th day of March. In the year 10. And welcome to this whorehouse where we do a roaring trade. Well, you may very well ask, what the heck is As I Please? And a good question, indeed, because it is difficult to maintain a, what we might loosely refer to as forward momentum with the regular intervention of alms begging. Alms for the poor. And currently, I am betwixt the devil and the deep blue sea. The devil and the deep blue sea of two different management systems, and yet astonishingly alike. What can one say? I guess management is management is management. And as we are the worker station, hell of them. That's what I say. I mentioned a while back that the tour company, which is where I earn my daily bread, rather arbitrarily and suddenly announced a schedule change which has forced me to work on Fridays, which means, of course, that I cannot plan this program to my satisfaction. Big deal, I know you say, but, you know, there's very little one can get out of this. So if I at least am satisfied, if I at least am pleased, perhaps one or two of you might be pleased. But, you know, I recognize, of course, that the tour company doesn't care, and really, frankly, they shouldn't care. They've got their agenda, I've got mine. What is more annoying, of course, is that management at the radio station apparently doesn't care, because could they tell me in advance that I was preempted? No, because that apparently would be too much. Now, I don't really know who's out there, but it is my suspicion that if you are tuned into the radio now, you have chosen to do so. I am wrong, perhaps, but that's my feeling. I grant, there are a couple of nut jobs who apparently haven't figured out how to change a radio dial or the intricacies of the on-off switch too much for them. And these are the people that we regularly hear from online and elsewhere. How dare you? But for the rest of you, you have chosen to listen to this program. And consequently, I feel I owe you the best I can do. And alas, when I don't have time to prepare a program, all things suffer. My home life, my private life, my career, my professional life, all these things suffer. Why? Because I don't get the time alone necessary to be in this room alone, to talk to myself alone in the dream that you are listening. The thing is, of course, and this is my main point, is that when you get a hiatus like this and forced upon us, it requires a lot of effort to sort of catch up or to recover lost ground. And, you know, it's difficult because it's clear, I think it is clear, that y'all don't really recall what happens from week to week. And how do I know this? Because I have to tell the phone number endlessly because it just slips your mind. Let me give you that phone number now so you can write it down so that when we return to fundraising, though I probably will not be here, you'll know the number at any rate. And that number is 209-2950. You can call that number right now and no one will answer, which is in itself a glorious thing. But you should write that down so that the next time we do fundraising, it will save me having to repeat it at least once, or repeat it twice. In any case, I am not so crabby that I like to go backwards. Consequently, shows that I have prepared are gone. And I just thought you would like to know that thanks to a management decision, of which I was not informed until 2 o'clock in the morning, you've lost the Tip Top Tet program. Yes, for nearly 20 years, I have celebrated the coming of the Lunar New Year with a celebration of classic Chinese literature, primarily poems. And each year I prepare trying to find things to excite you and wow you. And so I did. And then I was canceled. And so, you've lost Tip Top Tet, but I did have a wonderful week in preparation. Now, why don't I just do that program today? Because it's old hat, and I must move on. There is really no one I can talk to about this. And just once again, end up talking to myself, grumbling to myself, because who really cares? What is the value of this program? You can't put dollars and cents on it now, can you? And yet, we are required to, periodically. And when we learn that the substitute program raised more money than this program, one wonders, should we bother at all? Remember, you are responsible for the maintenance of this radio station. Well, anyway, why bother you with my problems? What difference does it make? Especially when I can turn to someone who talks about himself far better than I ever will, and I mean, in this case, the great Ben Johnson. Yes, as long as I have to introduce myself, I may introduce myself by saying, you don't need to know who I am. What you do need to know, however, is more about Ben Johnson. Yes, I know, it's a one-man campaign to bring a renaissance to renaissance literature. There we go. And so I turn now to Ben Johnson, who I think is woefully unappreciated in our day and age. If you have read deeply in Shakespeare, and I hope some of you have, then turning to Ben Jonson, you will immediately recognize the differences. If Shakespeare and entire Renaissance theater is still something of an open book to you, Ben Jonson deserves your attention. Now, this poem I'm about to read dates from 1629. Now, Shakespeare had been dead for about 13 years at that point, although we still call it the Age of Shakespeare. But in 1629, Ben Jonson was it. He was the man. He was the bestseller, the leading playwright. He was just about everything, and sometimes referred to as the first poet laureate as well. What I like about Ben Jonson was that he was not knighted. You know, he's a self-made man. Oh, we like that. And what I also like about him, intensely independent. Another good reason to turn to Ben Jonson. And if Jonson wasn't exactly the avant-garde of his time, but he was hip. He was the thinking man's playwright. Now, let me pedal back a bit to say that I love Shakespeare, as you know. But Shakespeare has a remarkable ability to be popular and appealing. Jonson, far more satiric and far more cutting, and just worth investigating. You may not fall wildly in love with Ben Jonson, but you might, in fact, respect the man and the work he accomplished. Any case, this poem was published in 1629, right after the presentation of his latest play, The New Inn. And there was, I dare not call it criticism. There was a response to this play by reviewers of the time.